Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. When it comes to meeting the world's energy needs, more is better. What we mean is our world needs a wide range of energy sources to meet our increasing needs. Just wind or solar won't get us there, as the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. With our growing population and the increasing use of energy-demanding technologies like AI, reliability is key. And the reliability of natural gas is unmatched by wind and solar. That doesn't mean we all can't work together, but natural gas is vital to ensuring we meet our energy needs. Look around, and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 140, Brazil in World War II, Part 4, The Aftermath. In this last episode on Brazil's involvement in World War II, we're going to look at what happened once the war was over, and how this involvement affected the future course of the country. How much of what Brazil wanted to achieve before entering actually came to pass when the war was over. It was, of course, those German naval attacks which were the immediate and direct spark for Vargas's decision to declare war. The idea would have been long considered, however, its pros and cons weighed up. For Vargas, his government, and the country as a whole, the motivations for joining were not simply about defeating fascism, getting revenge on Germany, or even just to cement their relationship with the USA. A war can help to achieve all sorts of political objectives and change a country's geopolitical standing. Vargas had all sorts of things he wanted to achieve through involvement in World War II. His foreign minister even wrote these out in a convenient list. They were 1. A better position in world politics. 2. A consolidation of Brazil's superiority in South America. 3. A more secure and closer relationship with the United States. 4. Developing greater influence over Portugal and the Portuguese colonies. 5. Development of Brazilian maritime power. 6. Development of air power. 7. Development of Brazilian heavy industries. 8. Creation of a Brazilian military industrial complex. 9. Creation of industries, such as agriculture, extractive and mineral enterprises, to complement those in the US, which were essential for post-war world reconstruction. 10. Expansion of Brazil's railways and roads for economic and strategic purposes. And 11. Exploration for essential combustible fuels. We saw last episode that once the Germans were pushed from Italy, Vargas began the process of bringing the expeditionary force home, rather than taking up the request to assist with the occupation of Europe. Now, things could have really gone the other way. Vargas did play with the idea of sending the expeditionary force to the Pacific to assist in the war against Japan, which of course would continue after victory in Europe. Brazil's policy had been to only fight if attacked, something Germany had done, but Japan had not. But Vargas seemed willing for a short time to put this policy aside. The US wasn't really fussed, however, and in the end, this is a footnote. It never really got close to happening. When deciding to bring the soldiers home, Vargas could justifiably argue that their mission was complete, and that they were not reneging on their commitment. This was a legitimate reason for the decision in itself. However, he appears to have been taking further considerations into account. There was a victory parade, in which the returned troops were given a welcome on the streets of Rio de Janeiro. Apparently the turnout was smaller than the one which had seen them off, however, and the onlookers didn't know what to make of them in their US Army uniforms. Instead of turning the smoking cobras into the basis of a new and experienced corps of the army, Vargas dissolved them, and so the veterans who remained in the army were dispersed across different units. Interestingly, this didn't happen with the 1st Fighter Squadron. They were kept together and given a new home at an airbase in Rio de Janeiro. The unit still exists today. Why exactly the dissolution of the Expeditionary Force was enacted is unclear and debated by historians. Vargas's position was rocky at the time, for reasons that are too complex to go into fully here, and perhaps he feared that a successful fighting force could focus opposition to his rule behind them. Perhaps he feared that, after fighting alongside the US troops in the name of democracy, troops for whom their democratic system was a source of pride, the Brazilian soldiers would have taken these ideas to heart. His position was a strange hybrid one, in which he was a semi-dictator, and as we are about to see, there were fears that he might not hold the scheduled upcoming elections. Analysis of the political positions of the veterans have thrown up mixed results. Certainly many did seem to have been influenced by the ideas for which they were supposed to be fighting in Italy. The ideas of democracy and an international outlook which the governments of the soldiers from places like the US and Britain, who they fought alongside, emphasised, would have made their way into the mindsets of their troops, and then been absorbed by the Brazilian soldiers as well. Perhaps these ideas would have been even stronger amongst the soldiers from occupied places, like France and Poland, who they also fought alongside, and who had gone out of their way to continue this fight, rather than stay at home as civilians in their occupied countries. That slight inferiority complex and the desire to overcome it, which helped inspire the government to get involved in the war in the first place, which drove the military leadership to be overly critical of its troops when they were pushed back by the SS near Lucca, and which helped to drive the ordinary soldiers to fight so hard, is perhaps relevant here. The Brazilians wanted to prove that they had an effective army, which could contribute. But they also knew that this army was behind other powers in terms of equipment and training, and of course had to rely on the US to provide equipment in the field. Perhaps for some of the veterans, the ideas of democracy and internationalism were connected to the advanced nature of their allied armies. All of this could have made the returned soldiers enemies of Vargas's political project. There are other historians, however, who have argued that many of the veterans remained conservative and nationalist, and that their political positions were rewritten in the 1950s, when the internationalist faction of the military managed to take control. Vargas's fears of hardened veterans causing political problems for him never came to pass, not because of anything to do with those veterans themselves, but because you didn't need to have fought in Europe to cause him trouble. Before the final order could be given to start shipping the soldiers back over the Atlantic, Vargas was deposed in a military coup. His successors continued his plan to bring the expeditionary force home, and so they were back in Brazil a few months later. They also continued his plan to disperse the veterans once they had arrived. A full overview of the next decades of Brazilian history is beyond the scope of this series, but I will outline them very quickly so that we can look at their relevance to the World War. It was those fears that Vargas planned to cancel upcoming elections that were the spark which instigated the intervention. He resigned before any blood was spilt, but the army had gathered outside the palace. When the elections were held, it was Dutra, one of those pro-Axis ministers, who won and ruled for the next few years. Vargas continued his political career, holding other positions, before returning to re-win the presidency 4 years later. Again, though, political turbulence resulted in some of the generals demanding his resignation once again, and instead he shot himself. The Republic lasted another 10 years after that, before a left-wing president was also deposed by the military. Unlike in all the previous instances, both before and after the war, they decided to remain in charge this time, and the military dictatorship began. So now we know that, it's worth going back to look at those objectives which the government had set out, to see if they were achieved, as well as to see if we can glean any impact which the war had on the political events which followed.
Did you know the most infamous pirate Blackbeard never actually killed anyone? Or that Christopher Columbus came up with the word cannibal and then used it to justify enslaving people? Did you know the diamond industry has been a complete scam since the 1870s? Or that a woman may have taught the famed Greek philosopher Socrates? Let's fix that. I'm Shay LaFontaine, and every week on History Fix, I take a deep dive into super interesting, lesser-known, and often misunderstood stories from history you will not be able to stop thinking about. This is not your high school history class. I guarantee at least one jaw-drop moment in each and every episode. You can find History Fix wherever you get your podcasts or at historyfixpodcast.com.
Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. When it comes to meeting the world's energy needs, more is better. What we mean is our world needs a wide range of energy sources to meet our increasing needs. Just wind or solar won't get us there, as the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. With our growing population and the increasing use of energy-demanding technologies like AI, reliability is key, and the reliability of natural gas is unmatched by wind and solar. That doesn't mean we all can't work together, but natural gas is vital to ensuring we meet our energy needs. Look around, and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
In terms of improving Brazil's position on the world stage, the expedition was a qualified success. It certainly did raise the country's global standing. However, it did not win them the hoped-for seat on the UN Security Council. In regards to this, and several more of their objectives, the decision to bring the Smoking Cobras home, instead of participating in the occupation of Europe, hampered their success. They probably would have been included further in the post-war global settlements if they had. They also might have achieved more when it came to their relationship with the USA, another of their key aims. This was partly out of their hands. They improved relations greatly through their participation. However, the key ally, Roosevelt, died, and subsequent politicians were less bothered about the relationship. There was a feeling that if they'd stayed in Europe after the war, this relationship could have been further cemented. So too could have been the amount of support they were able to extract from the US. During the war, the Americans had been happy to provide material support, and this benefited Brazil. Of course, though, it was conditional, and so more could perhaps have been gained post-war. Going the other way, the US managed to win an agreement which gave them the right to continue to use 3 military bases in northern Brazil until 1955. On the whole, though, good use of the support which did come had been made. The war helped Brazil develop its industry, another of those original aims. This process of industrialization for the war effort had a massive positive effect on the USA and helped propel it to the world's most powerful nation. A similar process happened in Brazil, and its economy developed rapidly, even if this is on, of course, nowhere near the same scale as in the USA. The steel industry bloomed in particular. One of the original geopolitical aims had related to Portugal and its colonies. There had been an idea that Brazil might become the dominant Lusophone power. This one sort of went by the wayside. There had been that initial idea of garrisoning Portuguese islands, but the soldiers went to Italy instead, and the post-war order made Portugal less relevant. The final set of objectives related to the military itself. The aim of transforming the military into the most powerful one in South America was definitely achieved. Nowhere else could challenge them now, and nowhere else had a set of veterans who had fought, even if they were now dispersed. Although the Smoking Cobras had to rely on US-provided equipment, at home, the country purchased and began producing things like tanks and artillery. The character of the army changed as well, becoming more modern and professional. Its officer corps was no longer that vehicle for middle-class social mobility, which inspired those joining, primarily because of future opportunities it could give within civilian society. People started joining up to become officers with the intention of making that their career. New training programs were also created based on what had been learnt in Europe. It's hard to say how much the war influenced the military's eventual establishment of the dictatorship in the 1960s. Obviously, the world had moved on by then, and their actions fit into the wider trend, which saw militaries take power across the region during this time period. The fact that the series of post-war coups before that one looked like the pre-war coups and resulted in elections is also informative. All of this suggests that it would be incorrect to draw a direct line from the expeditionary force and its impact on the army to the later military regime. It may have indirectly contributed a little bit in some way, however. Once the expedition had returned home and Vargas had been deposed the first time, the army, navy, and air force were united into a general staff for the first time. This was probably partially inspired by what the military had observed among other nations in the war, and it would allow them to coordinate better later on. The fact that the war and the expeditionary force did not result in a larger transformation of the army, however, into one which looked outwards, but instead continued to look internally for purpose, could be said to have contributed to the eventual military regime. They did not complete the process of converting their purpose into defending the nation's borders. Instead, they continued to see their reason for existing as defending the state from internal uprisings and political strife. While the Brazilian military has been extremely involved in internal affairs since World War II, launching all those coups, ruling the country during its dictatorship, and participating in Operation Condor, the country has not gone to war with another nation. It did send soldiers to the Dominican Republic during a civil war there in the 1960s, but this was as part of a force created by the Organization of American States, and 5 other Latin American countries also contributed to this alongside the USA. Their role was a peacekeeping one. On an individual level, Life for the veterans was not always easy in the years and decades following their return. One of the Expeditionary Forces leaders, Humberto Castelo Branco, remained in the army and became president of Brazil in the wake of the 1964 military coup when the dictatorship was established. He ruled for 3 years before resigning, and then dying in a plane crash a few months later. He had already been important before the war, but his actions and skill during it certainly helped launch him onto the path which would lead him to the very top. Many others, however, found life difficult. They found jobs outside of the military hard to come by. Although the law stated that those who were conscripted were guaranteed their old jobs back, in practice, many of their employers sacked them as soon as they could, often claiming that they were difficult to deal with and didn't perform their jobs properly. I don't have any more material to go on when it comes to this, so my guess is that perhaps some were suffering from PTSD. Those who remained in the army were often sent to the remotest of military bases across the country as part of the effort to break them up. They were also not allowed to publicly display their special uniforms or any medals they had won during the campaign. It wasn't until 1988 that they were given special military pensions. Many weren't around to collect them by this point. Vargas had promised them these in 1944, and although he can't take the blame for not implementing them immediately, being deposed, given that he did return to power, he can join the list of presidents who didn't award this recognition for their service. It seems that although the various governments which followed the war wanted to take advantage of the benefits which their service had won, the increased international standing, the development of war-related industries, and the tactics learnt to improve their performance, they all wanted to move on from the expeditionary force itself. The result of that was that the people who it was made up of were largely forgotten. If Brazil's involvement in World War II is often overlooked by the rest of the world because of the understandable focus on the big players, perhaps this desire to move on internally has also contributed to this. If the country itself has not tried to shout about their contribution, it's probably not surprising that the expeditionary force is little known abroad. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help out, one thing that's really quick and easy to do is to leave a review wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps new people discover the show and means that I can keep making episodes. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. What do you know about oil and natural gas? You likely associate them with running your car or heating your home. But these two natural resources fuel so much more than that. More than 6,000 consumer products that we rely on every day are made using oil and gas. Before you even step out the door in the morning, you've already used more products made possible because of oil and gas than you realize. From the toothpaste you brush your teeth with, the soap you washed your face with, and the sheets you slept on. Not to mention your makeup, contact lenses, clothes, and shoes. Oil and gas are vital parts of all these products and so many more. Look around and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.